This is The Guardian.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. COVID-19 is the story of our time. Daily numbers became a fixture of our day.
Sadly, I have to announce the death of 15 people today, 7 women and 8 men.
More than 5 million people worldwide and 4,000 in Australia have lost their lives to this virus.
Can I just express my sincere condolences for those that have lost their loved ones?
But what do we know about them?
People were in their 40s, 2 were in their 50s, 4 people were in their 60s, 3 people were in their 70s, 1 in their 80s, and 3 people were in their
90s. Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tisha about how we talk about the people who have died from COVID-19. It's Friday, the 4th of February. Welcome back to the Friday show. Hello, Lenore.
I am very excited to be here, Gabs.
Hi, Mike. Are you excited?
So excited. Can you hear it in my voice, how excited I am?
Yeah, yes.
Not really.
It's great to be back. Let's talk about death.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to have a massive tone shift here. Lenore, I know you've been thinking a lot this week about the Australians who have died from COVID. Almost 4,000 people, actually, have died in Australia. We know the numbers, we hear them, and we report on them every day. But the actual humans who have died feel so removed from our daily discussions. Why do you think that is?
Well, that is what I've been thinking about. I mean, you know, the pandemic is about death. That's what we've all been so desperately trying to avoid, either in terms of ourselves or for vulnerable friends and loved ones. And that's why we've been enduring all the stuff that we've been enduring for 2 years. So sort of science could catch up with this pandemic and avoid the deaths. And yet sometimes, somehow, we don't talk about the death all that much in all the stuff that we write about it. Not as much as you would expect anyway, in my view. And maybe that's because we're all still so busy coping with the day-to-day of it, just getting through it. Maybe it's because it's hard to talk about. Maybe it's because the deaths are usually presented to us as statistics. And I think that goes to the heart of it. When policymakers want us to be afraid, wanted us to stay home, we did get human stories. We got health officials at the press conferences. We got occasionally even led into hospitals to see the horror of it. Mm. But now that we're supposed to be getting on and living with COVID, it's all of these statistics. You know, sadly, we're reporting the deaths of X number of people who are in their 40s, 50s, whatever.
Sadly, I have to announce the death of 15 people today, 7 women and 8 men. 2 people were in their 40s, 2 were in their 50s, 4 people were in their 60s, 3 people were in their 70s,
and
1 in their 80s.
You know, we hear that they maybe have underlying conditions.
And the child from southwestern Sydney died at home and had significant underlying health conditions, and a man from...
But not much more than that. And when you stop and think about it, though, the death toll, you know, nearly 4,000 Australians as of February, 5.7 million people across the world, That's extraordinary. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. If you resort back to statistics, we are proportionally still low in the death rate, and you don't want to sensationalize it or make people afraid, but the human story of the pandemic is, right underneath it, a story about death, and I do think that those human stories have been underreported. I really do.
But, Mike, it's not unusual for us to not want to think about our mortality, is it? Do you think that's part of why we're kind of like maybe not thinking about the actual people and their lives who have been lost?
Perhaps, although I think it's probably more some of us think about death, I suppose, more than others, our own deaths. I think it's more to do with the fact that, as Lenore said, we just get this number every day. And until recently, it's been a pretty low number. It's only in the last month or so that it's really got to quite different levels, where we're talking about, you know, tens of people dying every day, up to even 100 on the worst days across Australia. And it's just a number. We don't have those stories. We're not thinking about, like, if you read an individual story about someone who's died in any kind of circumstances, obviously you think about that person and their life. But you know, until you know the names or the stories of those people, then it's just kind of, and because it's every day and it's a formula in the statistics that are presented at the press conferences and media releases and so on, then yeah, it's kind of easier to not think about the people.
I think that is a point, Mike, that, you know, in a way we can hide behind statistics, because unless you're a health worker or an aged care worker or someone who happens to be directly affected, you don't see it much. You don't see it really up front, unless it's a famous person who died, like Glenn Wheatley this week. You don't see the faces and you don't hear the stories. And maybe we sort of manage some of that existential anxiety a bit by taking refuge in the statistics, by, you know, looking at the case numbers and the deaths in our country or our state or our suburb and thinking, okay, it's not near me. But obviously it can be anywhere. And the unavoidable truth is that certainly in the previous waves, and to an extent in this wave as well, families were often much less safe if they lived in low socioeconomic areas or in suburbs where language barriers made it harder for services to get through. Or as our Indigenous editor, Lorena Allam, wrote, I think it was last week, you know, that COVID is really out of control in Central Australia. I think this week we read that Elko Island is in lockdown. So there are places where people see it. But for a lot of us, you can, if you want to, sort of hide behind the statistics.
I think there are also a few factors that have kind of blurred into each other that have made people not focus on the deaths or not take them as seriously as we might have otherwise done. One is the idea that Omicron is a milder variant of COVID, which it is, in the sense that it doesn't cause as much death than with the previous Delta variant. But as we know, it's much more transmissible. And so that has made people feel like maybe COVID is not responsible for the deaths somehow, I think. And that's exacerbated by some of the statements that politicians have made about who is dying and how they're dying and whether it's caused by COVID or whether they're dying of COVID or with COVID, which is, I think, quite maybe not deliberately disingenuous all the time, but sometimes does certainly have that effect of masking what kind of a factor COVID is in those deaths. Certainly for hospitalizations, it's true that people are being counted as being in hospital with COVID when they may have been admitted for something entirely different. But for deaths, if COVID is recorded on the death certificate, that means it has certainly contributed to their death in one way or another.
Yeah, the epidemiologist Gideon Mijovits-Katz made a really good point on Twitter this week. He said, you know, talking about how all these deaths are reported of people who have had underlying comorbidities or conditions, he makes the point that most adults in many countries have at least one underlying health problem, like I do. And the Frances Ryan, The Guardian's amazing disability and inequalities writer, wrote that it makes people with disabilities feel like their lives don't matter.
Yeah, I think there's a fair bit of that going on. I think there's also a fair bit of trying to sort of, by politicians, in fact, of trying to sort of massage statistics to make things look less bad, if you like. Certainly in terms of how the federal government's talking about aged care and what is clearly a crisis in aged care. Statistics come out every time they're asked about it. Richard Colbeck, the aged care services minister, you know, he's the one who didn't go to a parliamentary inquiry looking into COVID because he decided to go to the cricket in Hobart instead. He was defending that decision in front of a parliamentary inquiry this week.
I'm very careful to balance and acknowledge the different elements of my portfolio. And all of during that week.
And he actually denied that the aged care sector was in crisis at all.
And I was very cognizant of the circumstances that the sector was in. In fact, all through that weekend, I continued to work on matters relating to...
When, you know, half of our aged care facilities have COVID, and he tried to hide behind statistics. He said that in 2020, there were 28,000 COVID cases in Australia, and just 7.2% of them were in aged care. And now there's 1.8 million COVID cases and only 0.58% of them are in aged care. But that's 10,500 cases. That's 650 deaths. I mean, I think they deploy statistics in a way to get around questions about the reality of it. I think the Prime Minister actually takes that even further.
Let's talk about our health response more and the health resilience that we've built up.
And uses statistics comparing Australia's death rate to OECD averages to claim that he has actually saved 40,000 lives.
More than 40,000 lives have been saved in this country when compared to the death rate from COVID in other countries just like Australia.
I think some of the way statistics are being deployed is kind of disingenuous and is actually deliberately trying to sort of build a wall between people and the reality of what's happening at the moment.
Hmm. And obviously those statistics comparing us with the OECD are going back to the beginning of the pandemic, when we know that for various reasons Australia was protected through lockdowns and through border controls from the Delta waves that swept across Europe and the US and other places for most of the pandemic. But the statistics for the recent, for the month or so that's just gone past, are of a completely different order. I mean, I know we don't want to talk about, not, we're trying to get away from just talking about the numbers, but we should be clear about how many people we're talking about compared to our normal death rates.
Yeah, and since everyone always compares COVID to the flu, let's look at that. In 2019, 1,080 people died from the flu. We've already had way more than that, close to 2,000 just this year alone.
Hmm. You could compare it with car accidents, which people often, you know, think of as a leading cause of death, which it is a terrible cause of death, but that's like currently about 1,100 a year and has been for the past few years across the whole year for the whole of Australia. And we've had that many deaths since the start of January. So we're talking about a lot of people, whichever way you cut it.
Mm. And even if they were already sick, even if they did have cancer or were somehow palliative, it's still a life ended too soon.
Mm.
Minister for Health Greg Hunt was talking about the number of people who are palliative, quote unquote, who have died.
Are you satisfied with the current situation in the aged care sector, the spread of cases and deaths growing and quite stark on the weekend?
What was he talking about?
The point he was making was that on his advice, about 60% of those who had died in aged care had been in palliative care.
The definition is that they have passed with COVID and they are absolutely rightly counted as a national loss. But approximately 60% of those that have passed were in palliative care. And
our medical writer, Mel Davies, spoke to aged care workers and health workers about that comment, who considered it a bit disrespectful, the idea that, you know, these people were going to die anyway. Again, I feel like it's a sort of way of trying to wrap the reality in statistics that are trying to sort of make it seem less distressing.
Mm. So we've talked a lot about how we're not talking about these things. Lenore, why is it so hard to talk about this? How do you think about it as an editor?
Well, a lot of reasons. It's hard for a lot of reasons. The information released by authorities, like publicly released, is usually pretty sparse, for good reason, to protect the privacy of grieving families and of patients. The reporting obviously has to be mindful of people's grief and of their privacy. You obviously don't want to sort of overstate it and spread fear where it's not warranted. But I do think we have a responsibility to portray these stories, to portray the stories of people who are going to be terribly missed, by definition, by tens of thousands of Australians. We did have a series early in the pandemic called Lives Lost to COVID, and then it sort of fell away because the death rate really went down. And now we're taking it up again. Our reporter, Tori Shepherd, is picking it up again and talking to some families who want to talk about a loved one who's died, so we can start again to put names and faces and stories and personalities to the people behind the statistics. So I did want to say, if any listeners want to get in touch, want to tell a story, please do, because I think it's important that we tell the stories. And I've just been reading a few of the first ones that Tori has filed, and certainly the first story is about a woman who died with COVID, who was also battling lymphoma. So I don't know where she would fit in the ministerial statistics, but she sounded like an amazing woman. There were all sorts of lovely stories about her in Tori's piece, one of them about how her daughter busted her out of hospital so they could go and see Hugh Jackman and she sort of danced the night away. It was just a lovely, heartwarming piece about a woman who sounds like she was a wonderful woman.
Next, hypothetical paywalls and hypothetical ping pong balls. Okay, so now we come to what we can't get out of our head. Lenore, what could you not get out of your head this week?
Well, I guess I was quite keen to read the story about the New York Times buying Wordle because I, like many, many people, became quite addicted to Wordle in my holidays, and it was sort of my act of holiday defiance that I did Wordle every morning before I read any news. Of course, I can't do that now. Now that I'm back at work, that it's back to the evenings doing Wordle. But anyway, I really loved it and it was fun to sort of, you know, challenge my friends and, you know, it was fun. Anyway, now the New York Times has bought it, so of course, we wanted to see what would happen to it. The word is that it will initially remain free to current and new users. That doesn't mean it won't ever be behind their paywall. Anyway, for now, Wordle's okay and we can all keep playing. But we are looking around to see what other games there were. A friend of mine last night sent me a Wordle sort of knockoff game called Loodle, which is only using lewd words, which I didn't find nearly as good.
What was your first guess, Lenore?
No, I'm not telling you.
Okay, Mike, what could you not get out of your head?
So one of my favourite stories this week was the one about the proposals to revitalise Sydney Central Business District, recommendations delivered to the New South Wales government as part of the Future of the Sydney CBD report. I sort of feel sorry for the people who compiled it because obviously there's not one big idea that will revitalise the Sydney CBD, which is in dire need of revitalisation. And they had some good ideas in there, like free public transport late at night and that kind of thing. But the problem is they produce lots of small proposals, which in themselves may be fine ideas, but they tend to get latched onto by the news reports of what happened. So in our own story about it, our headline referred to the provision of ping pong tables in a CBD. And there was also a proposal in among them for a kind of new amphitheatre style, a public performance amphitheatre. And the Sydney Morning Herald illustrated their version of this story with like an actual Roman amphitheatre. Which I don't know if that was deliberate or not, but that would be a great addition to the Sydney CBD.
I want the ping pong table led recovery.
But yeah, who's gonna? Are we trusting people not to steal the balls? Is it like an honor system?
Exactly. I know. It felt like a lot of these things were slight thought bubbles. Anyway, there were some good ideas in there, and please revitalise the Sydney CBD. But I enjoyed the coverage of that story at least.
Well, thank you so much, Lenore and Mike. It's great to be back.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks a lot.
This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannon. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. And Laura Murphy-Oates, we'll see you on Monday.